Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we hear about the Witch's Yew in Blarney Castle, officially Ireland's Tree of the Year. We look at a conservation project to stem the country's dropping windchat population. And can you identify these insects? And just how do they make that sound? Now, most of us have been rattled and upset by noisy neighbours at some stage or other, but what about when we are that boisterous neighbour breaching the peace in our community? Not me, you may assert, but have you considered how the noise you generate in your everyday comings and goings could be having on local wildlife? A new study from Queen's University Belfast shows that noisy environments caused by human activity could have a devastating effect on birds. The research looks at how man-made noise caused by traffic can mask signals between robins, hampering their ability to communicate with each other through song. When a robin hears a complicated song from another robin, they know that bird is aggressive and respond quickly with their own song. But this study shows that robins do not respond as fast when there is background interfering noise, which could lead to unnecessary fights over territory, potentially greatly reducing bird numbers. Dr. Gareth Arnott is principal investigator in the study and is a senior lecturer at the School of Biological Sciences at Queen's University in Belfast, where he joins us from now. Gareth, tell us more about the study.
Thanks a lot, Derek. You provided a great introduction, really, to the study and a very good synopsis. So in this study, we were very interested in how background levels of noise, which, as you say, are increasing globally, really, where huge effects of anthropogenic noise pollution, and this is an increasing problem. So we were interested in how that may be affecting these vocal interactions in birds. So, of course, with birds, bird song has two very fundamental functions. One is to defend a territory, and the second then is to attract a mate. And so we hypothesized that the noisy environment that they may be exposed to may interfere with that communication. So really the study was placed in that realm of better understanding the assessment that goes on between birds whenever they engage in these vocal interactions, and also how noise may be disrupting that assessment process.
So what exactly did you do, Gareth? Did you have robin recordings? Did you have particular territories? I mean, what were the actual nuts and bolts of the experiment itself, of the experimental work?
Yes, very good question. So it was really a mixture of both things that you said. So we started off by identifying the territorial robins. So we were lucky enough to work in a very nice spot on the outskirts of Belfast, which is along the River Lagan towpath. And specifically, we wanted an area that was actually quiet because we want to manipulate the noise levels. So we identified the territories of the birds along this area. And then what we did was, once we'd identified those territories, we came back and we did a playback study. So in other words, from databases, we had accumulated various recordings of robins singing, and the song of a robin varies in complexity. So what we were able to do was create two broad groups. So we created a playback that comprised simple song, and then a playback that comprised more complicated song. And then what we did was, we either played those conditions back in quiet ambient conditions, or else we played them back whereby we had manipulated the sound to have white noise over the back of it. So in this way, we had four treatments. So each territorial bird that we identified was exposed to those four treatments. And that meant we were able to compare the response whenever they heard the simple song without noise, the simple song with noise, the complicated song without noise, and the complicated song with noise. And then we were able to compare their behaviour between those different scenarios.
So are each robin's song, are they actually individual to the robin? So the robin sitting on the territory would obviously have his song, but the ones that you were playing back, would he think they were all one robin, or would he think there were various robins depending on whether it was complicated song or simple song?
That's a very good question, in the sense that you're exactly right, that each individual robin in those territories will have developed its own characteristic song pattern. And the song that the other individuals hear from that individual is an integration of everything that's went on in that bird's life to get to that point in time. In other words, what I mean is early life development and the levels of food, etc., that that animal would have had during development, they influence the quality and development of that individual, which in turn influences the quality of the song that it sings down the line. So yes, each individual will vary in the characteristics of its song. You're also right that the songs that we played back will likely have been perceived as being different individuals because we accumulated different playbacks from a database that represent different individuals.
Garrett, I have a model in my head of what goes on in robins. I gathered that a robin has a repertoire of phrases that it builds up.
Yes.
And it constructs its song by selecting about four of these phrases, yes, alternating high-pitched ones with low-pitched ones.
Yes.
And it establishes its territory. Now, I thought that it didn't embellish these phrases as time went on. I didn't think they got more complex, that the phrases, or that the number of phrases increased or anything like that. And then I understood that the neighbours, just as we know our neighbours and their behaviour, and we don't get alarmed when we see a neighbour retrieving a football ball from our front garden, whereas we would get very upset if some total stranger we never saw before was frolicking around our front garden. So our response to a stranger is much more exaggerated than our response to the familiar neighbours. Now, I understood that in the robin world, it was the same. They all knew each other more or less, and they could not waste time displaying too much, singing too much. But when a stranger comes in, such as your recording, here comes somebody in from outside who has no business here, wants to take over, take my mate, take my territory. So this is a very complex situation. Is that a correct model of what's going on?
That's a very good synopsis and analogy. So what you're describing there, Richard, is the dear enemy effect. My broad and main research area is studying contest behavior in a range of animal species. And yes, you're exactly right that once an animal has established a territory and the neighbor is also usually established, then you're absolutely correct that actually the levels of aggression decrease between the neighbour and the territory holder. And this is because they've established their territory boundaries. They learn to recognise the song of each individual, as you say. And so from an evolutionary point of view, it would not be adaptive to keep investing in a very vigorous interaction with that neighbour when the territory has been settled, known as the dear enemy effect. But equally then, you're right that what happens if a stranger comes into the territory, and you're absolutely right that our playback would have represented a stranger, then what you see is this rebound effect where they should display and be very aggressive towards this intruder on their territory. Within the contest dynamic then, there's also a very well-known resident intruder asymmetry, whereby the resident usually has a much higher advantage in the contest in terms of winning that interaction. And that's thought to be because that resident has invested so much in that territory that that resource is of a higher value to that resident. So they're more motivated to defend that territory than an intruder who may be less informed about that territory.
So now let's listen to you. You have your complicated song. You have your nasty, new, aggressive robin in the place. And the resident robin hears this and goes mad altogether. But now what about the noise? What about this white noise? This, if the robin on the territory hears the nasty regressive robin, but there's noise, white noise involved, this actually distorts the message and he's not responding the way he should. Is this what your research has finally shown us?
That's exactly right. Under normal circumstances, when we do the playback of the simple versus complex song, the bird that hears that song shifts its behaviour accordingly. In other words, what it does is whenever it hears the complex song, it shifts up a gear in its aggressive response, so it is more quickly to respond by its own song, and it also sings at a higher rate. These were two of the measures we looked at. And so that's what happens under normal ambient conditions. What we found then was whenever we had the white noise on the back of those playbacks, the territory holder wasn't able to make that discrimination between those two types of song. In other words, it lost the ability to make the assessment of the difference between the simple and the complex. And of course, ours was a very artificial scenario. But as you say, that would suggest that under real world conditions, whenever, let's say, traffic noise is in the background, the bird may not be able to adequately distinguish the level of threat from an intruder. So potentially that has quite big implications if that is the case.
Gareth, you mentioned a different level of singing, complex and simple, in robins.
Yes.
Now, is that the case? Robin has its repertoire and it sings, and the neighbours do likewise.
Yes.
If a bird comes in from outside, it's different, so okay. Mm. But it does, over time, the complexity of a robin song increase? Or is it the case that a robin that's challenging invents a more complex song simply because it's challenging, whereas it relies on a simple song if it's not? Is there some factor like that going on?
There is, to the degree. So you're also right that in this study, for the purposes of the study design, we have created these artificial categories of a simple song and a complex song. But you're absolutely right that it's on a spectrum. And when I use the term complexity, complexity in our case was made up of four elements, which comprise the duration of the song, the number of syllables, the syllable diversity, and the number of transitions between different syllable types. So in other words, we came up with a metric of complexity. But what would be the case under natural conditions is each individual will be on a spectrum along that level of complexity of their song. And it's thought that that level of complexity is a measure of the quality of that individual, representing its previous developmental phases that have got it to that point in time. So that is one element. But the other element is that there's a degree of behavioural plasticity. In other words, the bird can change elements of its song depending on the level of threat. So there's a dynamic element to the ability of the bird to change elements of its song depending on the threat level from the intruder.
Suppose I'm a robin and I'm flying into an area, I want a territory, then do I come in with a much more elaborate song? Is this an indication to the settled ones there that I am a challenger rather than just an interloper moping around?
So it's a good question, because honestly, to my knowledge, we haven't studied that effect. In other words, I don't know the level to which challengers vary in the complexity of their song, but I would hypothesize, as you say, that the individual that's coming to try to take over that territory, it would be in their benefit to give the most aggressive signal that they can. And part of that most aggressive signal is the complexity of the song.
So then if just white noise, if just traffic noise, and the resident robin doesn't hear this properly, then he doesn't hold on to his territory, he doesn't realise it's a threat. But that just stops them fighting. Isn't that a good thing? I mean, is this perceived to be a bad thing? Will the territory end up divided in two? Is it bad for the survival of the robins not to be able to hear communications properly?
Yes, that is a very good question, to the sense of why is it important? Well, I'll come back a step and say that these contests are absolutely fundamental. So a contest determines the unequal distribution of resources in the environment. So in other words, it determines the ability of that individual to secure a territory, which in the case in early spring will be to have a nest site, to be able to rear offspring, and to be able to feed and develop those offspring. So if the noise is interfering with the ability of that individual to hold that territory, it may be, for example, that it could lose a nest site halfway through, or it may be that it's disrupted from feeding the offspring. So this will have big effects on the tenure period on that territory. And ultimately, what we hypothesize is it will have an effect on the fitness of that individual bird. And by fitness, we mean survival and reproduction and the number of offspring. And within evolutionary biology, of course, everything is really about survival and reproduction for that animal.
So, Gareth, yes, there's some work in, I think, the University of Sheffield a few years ago upon this, or not quite this, about traffic noise and robins. And I think the finding was that the pitch of the song rose because higher pitched notes go out better in noisy environments than do lower pitched ones, apparently. So the pitch of robin songs in noisy areas was much higher than it was in quiet areas.
So
you you presumably compensated for that. But my question really is natural selection forming a new type of subspecies of robin that lives in very noisy places or something like that? Is this an evolutionary thing, or is this plasticity just a sort of a thing that things adapt to on the spur of the moment, or is it something they inherit from their parents?
So you have just hit on a question which is a very active research area. So we are currently asking the question, is it behavioural plasticity? In other words, as you correctly say, what happens typically in a noisy environment is the bird will shift the minimum frequency of its song upwards. So it'll shift the pitch upwards. It also does a thing which we do called the Lombard effect, which is if we're in a noisy pub, we unconsciously start to speak louder, for example. So the birds will also sing at a higher amplitude. And so that can happen within a generation. So there's clearly some effect of behavioral plasticity there. But the extent to which that may be a selective pressure resulting in change over time through genetic manipulation, i.e. Selection and evolution, is currently an unanswered question. But the hypothesis would be if individuals that have shifted their song upwards do better in noisy environments, then that should be a selective pressure that should ultimately flow through in terms of their survival and reproduction. But as yet, we haven't been studying this area long enough to answer that question, but it's definitely a very interesting one that's currently being investigated.
Gareth, thank you very much indeed.
That's great, Derek. Very interesting to talk to you.
Gorgeous new terms to trot out at dinner parties, such as Lombard
effect. The Lombard effect, yes, exactly. Right. Okay.
Thanks, Gareth.
Good. All the best.
Good talk to you. Bye-bye.
You can visit the website anytime you like. It's rte.ie/Mooney.
The Lombard hot summer seems to know every time you're near, and the touch of a breeze gently stirs all the trees, and a bird wants to please my ear.
This summer in Europe it was hot, hot, hot. Here in Ireland, we wilted as temperatures of 28 degrees Celsius were recorded in Shannon, Valencia and Cork, not quite reaching the sizzling heights of 1887, which still holds our hottest ever record at 33.3 degrees. Can you believe it? Over in France this year, temperatures soared as an unprecedented heatwave hit, delivering a whopping 45 degrees Celsius high at the end of June. That's what our series producer Anna Letty flew into when she went on holiday to the south of France some weeks ago on the 29th of June. Anna is with us now with some questions for our panel on summer for observations. Anna, welcome back to the programme. You were on a few weeks ago and the programme hasn't been the same since. Listeners are flooding to us in their droves. Anyway, go on, you're on your holiday. What did you notice?
First of all, just to sort of give you a picture of the scene, it was absolutely steaming hot. Mm. We were in this area, beautiful area, in the middle of nowhere. Looking back on it now, I have this kind of fuzzy sort of Monet kind of picture in my head of olive green rolling hills and sprawling vineyards very neatly laid out and dusty roads and that sort of thing. And it was absolutely beautiful. It wasn't exactly teeming with wildlife, but one thing that you couldn't miss was the racket being made by these insects, which I thought were crickets or something like that. But my nephew, who had been on an exchange, reliably informed me that these were, in fact, what the French call les cigales, which, Aina, I think you would say are cicadas? Cicadas,
yes, indeed. They're insects. They hang around on the leaves, sucking the sap, and they really live in very warm places. Did you manage to get a recording?
Could you describe one, Anna, before what they look like?
It's quite a large insect. It could be, I don't know, the length of your thumb, a couple of centimetres, but it doesn't make the sound the way that grasshoppers do. So it's not a grasshopper. It doesn't have great big legs, and it doesn't make the sound with its legs. It is a fat insect. It's got two wings, and it makes the sound with its abdomen. It has plates plates in its abdomen, which it can flick over and back. It has a muscle behind these plates. Whether if you had a box with a tin lid and you were pinking it up and down, they can pull this forwards and backwards to make this enormous loud sound. And they then have amplifying, more empty chambers. They can amplify the sound. They can make it even greater. Only the males make it. And it's interesting because most insects are deaf. So that cicadas actually have ears as well, so they can hear this. And they do it in order to attract a mate. But the sound is so enormously noisy because it's to keep away the predators, which are the birds. It actually hurts the birds' ears to be listening to this.
So seriously, if we went to France to get some peace and quiet, we were not going to get it with these guys around. Their noise was
You brought some recordings, did you?
I did.
Was this at night you were hearing them, or during the day?
During the day.
Well, that's cicadas, because the crickets, the thing you hear at night, everyone thinks are cicadas, are actually crickets, a relative to the grasshopper, a different group altogether. So if you heard them during the day, cicadas is your man. But there aren't too many species in the south of Europe. There are a few, but not too many. And I never saw France listed as a location of them, so they must be spreading.
Yeah,
with
but
the
it
heat.
Was 40 degrees in the minutes. It's so hot, they're actually able to withstand the heat. They can take the sap out of the leaves when it's too hot for the birds to be out. That's why normally Europe isn't hot enough. It's more an African thing. But this year, you had them in spades.
So, Anna, go on, yeah.
So I was out with a bunch of family members, and we were having a great old time and having lots of fun and lots of chats over the dinner table. But myself and my brother-in-law became intrigued because we observed that this racket would go on all day, and suddenly, as if a maestro conductor with his baton clicked
stop. Like a light switch, like the Book of Mormon, just stopped.
They would just stop, as if on a signal. And I decided, with my Mooney Goes Wild hat on, that this moment had to be captured. So one evening, I left my phone out, and my eagle-eared brother-in-law, Joe, actually noticed at the very moment when they stopped. Now that's noisy, right?
That is noisy, huh? Sounds like one individual.
Does it?
To me, it sounds like in the background there's lots of individuals together, but it sounds like just one animal. Maybe not, isn't it?
But there was certainly one very noisy guy. Oh, hold on now, what's happening?
Time,
stop! What's going on?
They all stopped at 10 to 10, but there is one guy in the distance still going.
Everyone around here has stopped.
At 10 to 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that has happened for how many nights?
Well, this is the third night, but not necessarily the same time. There have been 10 past 10, 10 to 10, and a couple of nights ago, we think it was about 20 past 9. Silence. Somebody switches off the switch.
Yeah.
God turns them off.
It's amazing. So my question is, how come they all stop at the same time?
Because they're stimulated by the amount of light that's there, and as the evening is coming and as it gets cooler and predators will now appear, they shut up. They're doing it to keep away the predators, but they can operate in the really hot and heat of the sun. Now it's getting cooler and it's getting darker, and suddenly their senses say it's now stop, because otherwise something will grab us.
And can I ask, is it a very ignorant question to ask, why do we need such noisy individuals?
Well, we don't need them. I mean, why does the world need us noisy people? I was looking at the noisy people on the back of your tape, and I'm wondering, you know, whether we had something else about robins and noisy people as well. I mean, why blame wildlife for noise when humans are very much better able to make fierce amounts of racket? I won't answer that question.
The noise is about mating. The male is calling. He's hidden, and he's calling out. And females hear this, and they come trooping in. Now, he's competing with other males around. It's very hard in the females. There is a gecko that waits around. It doesn't attack the male, but waits around until a female comes and clobbers her. So this gecko can exploit this by knocking off every female that comes to the male, which is a rather curious thing. So the noise is about getting your message out and getting it stronger than the man next door, I suggest.
Well, I also encountered some much quieter creepy crawlies while we were out there. We were in right down in the south of France, about 9 kilometres from the sea and in the middle of nowhere, but somehow we managed to find ourselves in a villa beside a band of musicians, which was really very fortuitous.
And very noisy, I'm sure.
Point taken. So we were all going over to join them one night, so we were carrying tubs of food and so on. And as we were going, one of my nieces and nephews observed a long trail of marching ants. Mm. And again, I whipped my phone out to capture this, and I just couldn't figure out they weren't carrying anything. They didn't seem to be going anywhere for any particular reason, but a long, long train of ants that suddenly just seemed to disperse for no particular reason.
You've got a video of same.
It's on the website.
It's on the rte.ie/mini. But one man who has seen it is in our Limerick studio. He's retired professor of zoology at the University of Limerick, and he has particular interest in Irish insects, especially ants and bumblebees. John, now you've seen this video, haven't you?
Well, for a start, I think they were carrying things, but and the video, she was a little bit far away from the ants, but it's obvious that they are harvester ants, which are common enough around the Mediterranean area. Now, amongst ants, there are some ants that collect seeds, so it's referred to as granivory or grain-eating. So when you see them in the Mediterranean area, the start of her video, in fact, is at the nest, but she doesn't really show. They have a very large crater around the entrance, and then there's a long trail out to where they are actually collecting the seeds at that time. One interesting thing about harvester ants is that, unlike any of the ants we have in Ireland, the ants have different size workers. So there are big ones and little ones amongst the workers. So it's separate sizes. And the big ones actually chew up the seeds and make a paste out of them for eating. And in fact, if you look carefully at that video, you can see the different sizes on the trail.
But are they coming or going, John? I mean, if they're leaving the nest and going, then they're not carrying anything. If they're coming back, they are. So are these coming or going?
They were going towards the feeding site, and the place where you mentioned that they disperse is actually where they have gone to collect the seeds. And so they disperse around there, and they're probably collecting mainly grass seeds.
So they don't come back in the same line. So the line going out...
They would be coming back in the same line.
But the ones that Anna videoed were the ones going out not carrying seeds. They were going out looking for them.
Yes, but they would be. Some of them would be coming back and possibly ground up as well.
John, could I ask you about this ant motorways that they establish? It seems to me rather odd. If you look at their relatives, the bees and wasps, they will head off in all directions from the colony, and the good ones, the ones that find things, will come back and tell the others, and everybody will go there then. But they disperse and they comb the whole area. But if you have a dedicated motorway going off out, you're not going to find new sources of food and resources. So how do motorways get established, and do they have experimental ants going out looking for alternative routes so we can build new motorways out to those? I mean, what's going on here? Why have a motorway anyway?
Well, there are people who study this thing. They call it studying optimal foraging. And the idea is that there are some foragers going out, and eventually they decide that another area is a better site to be going to, and then they move in that direction.
So can you interrupt the line? If you put your foot in the way, what would happen?
You'd interrupt it temporarily. But for the time being, they're going in that direction, and they're definitely going in that direction.
And would they sting anyone who tried to stop them?
Yes, those ones do have stings. But I wouldn't consider them major stings, but they do have stings.
John, we heard earlier that the cicadas, the seagull, they become noisier when the weather's hot. Do ants become more active when the temperature rises?
In general, yes, but quite a few of the species in the Mediterranean area would have a sort of a siesta during the day, because if the ground goes above, I think, around 40, 45 degrees, they then stop foraging. So there would be a lull at the height of the day when it's at its hottest.
So what impact will the heating up of the world, the global warming, have on these? Will they move further north in Europe? What do you think, John?
I could see the possibility that they would indeed, yes. But the Messor species are effectively desert species. And the adaptation to eating seeds and things means that gives them their supply of food and also mostly most of their supply of water.
And how does their behaviour, if at all, differ from their counterparts in South America? Aina, you did a documentary from the rainforest and had an encounter with ants.
That's right. We were looking at these leaf-cutting ants and they went off and they chewed up bits of leaves. And we encountered them coming back and they were all carrying bits of leaves over their heads.
They're taking those leaves into the nest.
And the leaves are about 40 times the size of the ant.
That is correct.
And do they eat the leaves?
No, they don't eat the leaves. Actually, they take the leaves into the nest, clean them very well, and then they cut them in smaller pieces. Once the pieces are small enough so they can chew them, they chew them, they add saliva and feces, and they make a spongy stuff with all of that. Then they leave that spongy stuff to ferment, and once it is fermented, then they plant the fungus in it, and that's what they eat.
Oh, so these are the famous ant gardens, where they actually are making a garden.
That is correct.
Those ones, Aina, would have a very similar sort of foraging strategy to these harvesters, in the sense that they would also go out on different trails and then suddenly change and go to a different tree for their leaves.
The Roman Empire comes to mind. There was a time where they had two emperors and they didn't get on, of course. This ended up in a complete split. Now, I believe that ant colonies, some of them anyway, have two queens. Now, in the bee world, the queen is the boss and she doesn't tolerate any opposition. Now, how do these two queens manage to function in one colony? Do they hate each other? Do they antagonize? Are they in kind of détente with each other? What is going on? Why have two queens anyway?
Well, I have to break the news to you that some of them have multiple queens.
I can certainly
say that on the one occasion that I've counted it, I've counted 18 queens.
Oh, my God.
So
These are an Irish black ant.
No, Brexit.
That was in Scandinavia. But the Irish black ant, Formica lamani, which you certainly sometimes see 5 to 10 queens in a nest.
These are the ones we have in our back gardens in Dublin.
No, the ones in your back garden in Dublin would have just one queen in the nest.
And they're there because we've all changed our backyards to having patios and slabs.
And they like pavements,
like that. So
are the queens sisters? Are they related to each other? Is there a vested interest in the progeny of the other one because she's a relative or anything like that?
They're possibly more related, but they're not necessarily sisters.
Why do they do this kind of thing? A huge colony of ants needs a lot of resources. If you're going to have multiple queens all there gathering it all up, this is going to eat into that, isn't it? Why did evolution go that way?
Well, there's at least one species in the wood ant group which occurs in the Alps in the general Switzerland area, and they're thought to be just a single colony. And there's at least one other species of Lasius that occurs in Spain. And some people joke that the colony covers the entire country of Spain.
They're all that.
They're all connected. All the nests are connected.
And they can move between one and another.
So it's one giant super colony.
How are your hairy ants in Ireland? They're the ones you were working on. Are they still around?
They're still around. In the 1970s, I knew about 200 nests. And then maybe 10, 15 years ago, I started getting panicking because I was seeing and I have to say, they're still not found in some of the woodlands where I knew them in the 1970s. But things have improved a bit. There are two people in the Woodford area, Donald Keegan from the Forest Service and Enda Mooney from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. And between them, they now have about 50 nests found. And in County Tipperary, there's a man called Eamon Drohan from Quilta, and he has also in the order of 50 nests. So things have improved, but we're trying to put together agreements so that the management of these, especially when you're clear felling the trees, that you're protecting the nests, and because these trees need aphids, which are green fly, but they're not necessarily green, but they need aphids to produce a source of honeydew. And so when there's clear felling going on, the idea is to keep enough trees to maintain the nests.
You mean the ants need the aphids for the honeydew?
The ants need the aphids, yes.
These are hairy wood ants.
These are the hairy wood ants.
And that's what they feed on, the aphids, honeydew.
Well, about 80% of the loads coming back in their case are within the gut of the ant, and it's honeydew, which is the excretion of the aphids.
So these ants are there probably since several thousand years. They must be an Irish subspecies of wood ant now or something like that. Are they unique?
In fact, I can happily say that there was one study done with collaboration. At that time, it was the University in Oulu. Hanna-Lena Mäki-Petaus was her name. And she did DNA analysis of Irish specimens. And yes, they are ever so slightly different to Formica lugubris on the island of England, in England.
Anyway, I preferred the sight of the ants marching away from our house than the ones that were marching into our cupboards.
Anyway, you lived to tell the tale, Hallie, you did.
Indeed, I did. And are you fond of these little creatures, John?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I would tell people that the marching into your cupboards is not a health hazard. The ants don't predict. It's just they're after grains of sugar and possibly grains of bread.
Yeah, they're free dustbin men.
And maybe for the sake of getting a little bit religious, could I be telling you that the harvester ants are, I maintain, the only, there's biblical approbation or whatever for, go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise.
That's a great quote.
It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers her food in the harvest. And so I always joke my colleagues that ant people have the biblical...
The imprimatur, yes.
Yeah,
indeed.
For doing their work.
John, thank you very much indeed. Very much appreciated. And if you want to have a look at Anna's video, you can visit the website, which is rte.ie/money. I'm tempted to say we should send you on more holidays so we can get more reports. And on the other hand, I'm thinking, your carbon footprint. Anna, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It just so happens that our own Aine Nilana is Vice President of the Tree Council of Ireland. Recently, we haven't had a chance to mention it till now, the Tree of the Year was announced. So talk about the Tree of the Year and what the Tree Council of Ireland has to do with it and all that kind of stuff.
Well, it's a competition, like, I mean, one dear to your own heart, it might be the Eurovision of trees, if you like. So we had the national competition. There were four trees nominated and people had to take votes on which ones they wanted. We had one out in Drogheda, the mighty Battle Oak, which actually was there when the Battle of the Boyne was fought. There was a Sweet Chestnut in Kildare and the Arbor Hill Sycamore in Dublin. But the one that won was the Tree of the Year, which is the Witch's Yew, and this is situated in the grounds of Blarney Castle in Cork. Now, this Witch's Yew is actually 600 years old, so it's very old indeed. And yews, of course, are mystical trees. They have a certain amount of mysticism going with them. This one is 600 years old in Blarney Castle, and we all know that the Blarney Stone, if you kiss the Blarney Stone, you get the gift of the gab. I nearly brained myself on the castle giving it a kiss, but as you can see, I have the gift of the gab from it. But anyway, the gift of the gab was given to it by a witch who conveyed to the people of the area this important information that you get the gift of the gab by kissing the Blarney Stone. Anyway, she was stuffed into a hole underneath the tree because you can't have witches wandering about. But she can come out at night time, and she wanders around the castle, but she's safely in under the roots of this wonderful yew tree during the day.
And if you kiss the tree, does anything happen to you?
I don't think anything happens to you. No, you wouldn't want to be kissing the tree. Yew trees are poisonous. Keep you away from the tree. But apparently there's a witch's kitchen, sort of a building that was built by the Jeffers family way back in the 1700s, beside this, an old ruin of a thing now, and quite often there's the dying embers of a fire there in the morning, which obviously the witch was up all night keeping herself warm. Anyway, this 600-year-old witch's yew is the Ireland entry now to the European Tree of the Year. So we want to win the European Tree of the Year, this wonderful tree. So now you have to go online. We all have to vote for our Irish tree as opposed to one from any other country.
And when is that competition taking place?
Oh, it's over the next few months, like anything else you want online. You actually vote for this.
Okay, we'll put the details on the website.
We want Ireland to win.
And if you happen to be in Blarney, have a look at the tree, the yew tree. 600 years old.
600 years old at least, because the centres of yew trees they go hollow in the centre, so it's difficult to core them. You know, normally if you want to age a tree, you take a core through the centre and you count the rings. But the yew trees become hollow on the inside. I mean, that doesn't make them fall down or anything, because as you know, the living part of the tree is the outside, the bark. But you can't core them as a consequence. So quite often, we know these are old trees because there'll be records of them when they were planted or something like that. I mean, the oldest tree that we know is another yew tree down in Inishfallen in Killarney. And in 1176, this was brought into the monastery in Killarney in 1176. And it was a tree at that stage. And it's still down there. And that's over 1,000 years old. So this is, while it's an old tree, it's not the oldest one in Ireland, but it's certainly the most famous one. And it's the one that we want to have as Tree of the Year for the whole Europe.
All right, visit the website rte.ie/money so you can have a look at this, the Irish Tree Council Tree of the Year, which is now entering into this European competition, and you can find out all the details of how you can go about and vote for it. Well spotted, well spotted indeed. The Tree of the Year, it's in Blarney.
pass by. He says I am a stranger and I'm lonely all alone. And would you kindly tell me where I'd find that little Blarney Stone?
There were giants in the sky. There were big, tall, terrible giants in the sky. High and you look below at the world you've left, and I think you know little more than a glance is enough to show you just how small you are.
Standing on the shoulders of giants is a phrase immortalized by one of the most influential scientists of all time, Isaac Newton, in a letter to his rival Robert Hooke in 1676. Newton didn't originate it, though. The credit actually goes to the 12th century theologian and author John of Salisbury, who wrote that sitting on the shoulders of giants, we see more. Not because our sight is superior or because we are taller than they, but because they raise us up and by their great stature add to ours. According to the 2018 Global Competitiveness Report, Ireland currently sits in 24th place out of 140 countries for spending in the area of research and development as a percentage of gross domestic product, or GDP. At any one time, it's estimated that there are about 7,000 full-time students here researching on PhD programmes, with a further 1,000 engaged in researching masters. I think it's safe to say that each and every one of them are standing on the shoulders of giants. Using the understanding gained by major thinkers from the past to make intellectual progress into the future. In our new mini-series, On the Shoulders of Giants, with Mooney Goes Wild biologist Terry Flanagan, we look at some of this groundbreaking research. Amy Gray is currently doing a PhD on windchats in the UCD School of Agriculture and Food Science. The windchat is a small bird which winters in Africa and arrives in Ireland in early summer. The numbers have been dropping recently and there are only about 200 pairs left here. Amy's research is funded by the Irish Research Council and she's been working on her thesis on the Shannon Callows since 2016.
Now we can see the male over there perching on a bit of meadow sweet.
Yeah, I see him. Quite a small bird, isn't he?
He's very small, very similar in size to a robin actually, but more of a kind of a buff orange breast towards the top and a very white belly. They're also very distinctive as well because of the white eye stripe that they have on the side, so that kind of distinguishes them. And you can even see this starting to appear in the fledglings as well, which are the baby birds, so it's quite easy to detect the baby birds. You can see their white eye stripe and they make a very similar sound to their parents, attacking kind of noise with a bit of a whistle.
Now, it's the whinchat we're looking at. And if we start by looking at the name, whinchat, everyone in Ireland knows that whin is another word for gorse or furs. And this place, there's quite a lot of it around. And I presume the chat comes from the sound of them, because that's what they're doing now, chatting.
Exactly, they are chatting. They're making lots of noise. The chat is their alarm call, and this is what you will hear in the breeding season. So you might hear it a little bit in the winter time, but it's much more effective when they are trying to protect their young from predators. They would perceive us as predators, so they would be making lots of noise in order to encourage the baby birds to hide in the vegetation and to stay out of danger.
Now, we're not actually anywhere near to them. We must be, 100 metres away, so they're quite quiet. They're not going crazy.
Yes, exactly. If we got any closer, I'm sure they'd be getting very upset and probably moving further away from the nest and leaving their chicks to fend for themselves for a few minutes, so we want to stay quite far away.
And there is a nest here.
There is a nest just over that direction in some kind of shrubby vegetation. There's lots of meadowsweet, bits of thistle, there's some nettle in the area. So this pair are actually extremely lucky that they have chosen to build their nest in an area that won't be mown by a landowner.
Because we are on the Shannon Callows. We're 30 metres away from the Shannon itself. And this floods this area, is that right?
It does indeed. So in the wintertime, this entire area will be completely impassable. We're actually on an island, so all of this area here completely flooded in the winter time, and the water only begins to kind of recede in about April. And these birds have quite a haven here in the summertime because the waters recede and there's lovely grassy kind of vegetation that comes up, and they can use this. It can be quite dense and they use that to build their nests.
Right, well, tell us a little bit then about your thesis.
It's a conservation project at the root of it. So I am looking at the whinchat. I'm trying to assess what kind of timeline they use during the breeding season. So when they arrive in the summer, they're an African migrant. They come over. They arrive usually at the end of April, beginning of May. And then the males arrive first and the females arrive a little bit later after this. And they pair up. And the female begins to build a nest. And
which is on the ground, I believe.
Exactly. So ground nesters are very interesting. They nest on the ground rather than in a tree. And they are able to make kind of cupped nests in the ground. Particularly the whinchat makes its nest out of moss and other softer materials. They make a nice deep cup, which they will lay around 5 to 7 eggs in. And the female will incubate these eggs or sit on the eggs for up to 2 weeks. After this, the chicks will presumably hatch as long as they haven't been affected by any kind of predation or poor weather conditions. Once they hatch, the pair, they feed the chicks for the next around 17 to 19 days. And after this point, the fledglings or the baby birds are, in theory, at the right age to kind of leave the nest. They'll leave the nest on foot. And then, of course, once they've left the nest on foot, they've got to begin to learn how to fly. And they will be observing their parents in order to achieve this. But even after they have fledged and left the nest and are able to fly, the adults will continue to feed them for a significant period. And they feed them insects. So that would be their main prey source, especially in the summer.
Do they have a second or a third clutch?
They don't have a second or a third clutch. Not
Unlike, say, blue tits or that.
Exactly. No, just they're single brooded, which is what we would call this species. They only have one clutch. Occasionally, the clutch might fail. And this could be due to a number of reasons, such as predation or any
kind of... Well, being on the ground, the likes of foxes. And we saw some fox poo there just a moment ago.
We did indeed.
So they are here.
Yes, they would be predated by foxes or also corvids, which are kind
crows.
Of the crow family.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And how many territories have you come across here on the Callows?
Across the Callows, my fieldwork sites are from Banher, the area that we're in now, up as far as Athlone. And I have found up to 62 pairs or territories. Of this, I've been able to successfully monitor for a long period of time up to 50 of these pairs.
That's very good, because they are in trouble numbers-wise.
They are indeed. So back in the 1990s in Ireland, we thought we had, you know, a couple of thousand, whereas now the estimates are around 200 pairs across
Ireland.
What's
the problem? Why are the numbers dropping?
Across Europe, definitely one of the most pertinent issues is the mowing of grasslands and the intensification of agriculture. On the Callows here in particular, I'm trying to investigate what is the main cause for the drop in the population numbers. But one of the main reasons, again, is the mowing of grasslands. So you can see where we are now. This was a lovely meadow that could have had vegetation up to a metre high. And now you can see we're just left to some stubble here on the ground. And it can be quite a challenge, even if the birds are to survive the mowing, for them to then find prey, which would be kind of winged insects that would be spending time in meadows, and also any kind of ground invertebrates that they might find on exposed land. I am very fortunate that I've been funded by the Irish Research Council to do this project and to carry this out for the next 2 years.
And you're also working through UCD, is that right?
Exactly. So I am doing a PhD, which is based in the UCD School of Agriculture and Food Science in UCD.
Okay, tell us what you've found out in the last year or two.
So what I found out in the last year or two is that it's very important to have decent weather in the springtime. Of course, these birds are...
This is for the birds and not for the researchers.
For the birds, exactly. So this species, they are migratory. They come over from Africa. They've got to make a huge, incredible journey in order to make it here. And if you have poor wet weather in the springtime, it becomes very difficult for them to actually make their full migration.
And what have your findings been so far?
The findings so far have been that definitely the whinchat are in trouble, for sure. Their populations are decreasing. So the main kind of components for this research project are to monitor the species throughout the breeding season to assess when the baby birds are actually flying, when they're able to avoid any kind of mowing machine coming in. You don't want them to hide in the vegetation, which is what very young baby birds will do.
Would you hope to be able to put forward some kind of suggestions after spending 3 or 4 years here as to how you could help them in this particular area here in Ireland?
Absolutely. That's one of the key aims for my research project. So collecting as much information as I can about the species. What are their requirements? When exactly do they fledge, and when are they most vulnerable? So when I find out this information, I can then make recommendations for conservation for the species. But at the same time, you can look at just the species and you can look at their particular requirements, and unfortunately, what can happen is you kind of forget about the human element. You forget about the people that are working the land. So it's very important to communicate with them as well. And that's another part of my project as well, the social component. Looking at the rural life, working with farmers, learn more about their knowledge and what they know, because they know a lot. They spend almost every day out here. So talking to them, see what they're willing to do, see if we can work together, is a huge important part of my project, kind of this working together to figure out what can we do for the species, because birds, like all wildlife, are important for everyone.
And you're not alone today. I see your supervisors here, Dr. Alex Copeland. What's he at now?
He is at the moment putting out some traps to hopefully be able to humanely and very safely catch some of our whinchat. He's put perch traps up that will hopefully catch an adult if they are attracted to the area. And he also has some spring traps that he is putting on the ground that might attract a fledgling, which is a baby bird.
Okay, well, let's go down and see if he's anyway successful. Okay, let's move on.
Oh, yeah, I think he has one.
Alex, you've got a bird in the hand.
I do, Terry, yes.
It is a whinchat.
It's a male whinchat, yeah.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's tiny, is the first thing I'd say. I thought you said it was the size of a robin. It's a little smaller than a robin, I think, is it?
A wee bit smaller, yeah. But not much.
Okay, and you're going to ring this bird now.
I am. I'm going to chuck on a small metal ring. These little metal rings, they have a unique number on them, so because this bird, particularly valuable because this bird's a long-distance migrant, it means wherever it gets found, we'll be able to trace it back to here, when it was ringed here today.
Their feet, they're absolutely tiny, aren't they?
They're, I mean, incredibly delicate. It's, you know, to be a ringer is, I mean, it takes years and years of training and experience to be able to handle some of these really small birds.
And the ring, it is so tiny.
It is. I mean, it has to be very small. I mean, you want them to be as small as possible so it's not hindering the birds. So, yeah. And they're made of aluminium, so they're very light. I mean, this is, it's a tiny fraction of the bird's weight. It's a bit like us wearing a wristwatch. So it doesn't impair them at all.
And that bird now will go back to Africa?
Hope so. We know it's probably feeding fairly big chicks in the nest at the moment. Once they've fledged, it'll hopefully be heading back off south again, maybe in August or September, back to wintering grounds in sub-Saharan Africa.
So you can't keep this in the hand for too long?
No,
you're taking away, so...
It's feeding chicks, so we want it to be getting back to feeding its young as soon as we possibly can.
So you're just noting the ring number now?
So the ring number, the species, obviously, we need to note its age, how old it is. What's interesting about this bird is it's actually in molt at the moment. You can see the feathers there,
yeah.
The primary flight feathers. You see these ones that are growing.
I see it. It's small. It's only about half the size.
It is. And you'll notice that it's exactly the same on the other wing as well. That
these feathers are
symmetric. Otherwise, the bird would fly in circles.
Right, OK. But do you know the one thing I noticed most particularly is that white line just across the eye?
The supercilium. Technical term, Terry, is the supercilium, that white stripe above the eye. Yeah, it's very noticeable. The other thing that you'll notice about them in the field is you see the white marks in the wing, the white bars in the wing, and also the white on the outer tail feathers.
That's not the white rump.
No, it's not white rump, but the central tail feathers are dark. The tail feather tips are dark, but it has these white feathers here. And when you see it fly and these open up, you see it flying away from you. And you see these two little white windows as the bird flies away from you.
Yeah.
So it's quite distinctive.
What
and
you
also,
you, want to weigh
you
it,
can just
it?
See little touch, not too much in this bird now. It's not very bright, but the little touch of sort of rusty coloured.
And of course, that's where the Latin name comes from too, as well, isn't it? And it's very similar to the stonechat.
It is. Oh, they're very, very similar to stonechat. They're very closely related to stonechat.
What's your worries then for the whinchat in Ireland or in general?
The worry is that the population is in decline, and it's in decline across the whole of Europe. And they're just not doing very well. It's a species that's struggling to survive in modern, probably intensive agricultural landscapes. It's also a species that is perhaps being affected by climate change. There's a suspicion that part of the reason that they're doing so badly is because they're struggling on migration to find food and sort of stopover points when they're on passage, particularly in the autumn. So it's a species that can be affected by a number of different things. It's the problem with these long-distance migrants is that they can be affected by a number of different conservation issues or environmental threats to them. So there's an awful lot going on or going against these poor little birds.
And I suppose the research that Amy is doing is of the utmost importance in trying to help these birds.
Absolutely essential, yeah. You know, it's really, really important. It's fantastic to have this work being done. I mean, whinchat was a species. It's always scarce in Ireland, but we didn't realise just how badly they were doing until the recent bird atlas, which showed that the population had declined massively in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Now it's gone on to the red list in Ireland. The declines have been so great. Yeah, very sad. So the callows here, I'm sure, as Amy was saying, is very, very important. for them. I mean, it's over half the national population is now on the Callows here. So trying to do something for them here is going to be essential to try and keep them in Ireland as an Irish breeding bird.
OK, well, look, I won't delay any longer because I know you want to get that little birdie back out to his family.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you, Terry. More from Terry Flanagan on the shoulders of giants next week. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to all of our contributors, Aina Nilana and Richard Collins. Our researcher is John Riley and the series producer is Anna Leddy. Until next time, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild is presented by Derek Mooney.